I am Josh Galindo. I've built several successful businesses utilizing the one tool everybody has, the mind. I am here to guide, coach, and prepare you. We will debate, discuss, and grow our minds together so you can obtain your own success. Fuck average, be legendary. This is my podcast. Well, we've got two special guests, incredible entrepreneurs, real estate gurus, good friends.
Influencers.
Okay.
Yeah, just smart dudes that are in the flipping business that I'm proud to have on the show. So thank you both for being here.
Thanks
we
for
have
having
Landon
us.
And Jesse Boakley.
Boakley.
There
appreciate
you go.
Yeah,
there
thanks for having us, guys.
Honestly, it's kind of an interesting podcast to have. The first time, you know, we hadn't really shot back and forth, you know. I don't think we'd ever had like a hour-long sit-down.
Mm-hmm.
But everything in me wants to go, okay, who are you? You know, and I know who you are. And then I want to go, okay, what do you do? I know what you do.
Right.
You know, but so this might be an interesting one to have, but
I think so.
We'll work our way through it and have some fun.
But it's fine to preface that with, you know, we've known each other for a while.
Sure.
When we got started in the business, you were obviously around, someone we looked up to, have learned a lot from. So there's not this, oh, tell me your origins, tell me where you're from. We're a lot past that. So I think we could actually talk about more where we're at today, and having a deeper understanding of each other might facilitate a better conversation than a lot of
pleasantries. I mean, I feel like
beautifully said.
This kind of comes around full circle, right? This is like the epitome of collaboration over competition nowadays.
Sure.
Right? From where we started 6 years ago to, you know, sitting here doing a podcast today together, shows, you know, collaboration, in my opinion, nowadays gets you so much further than that extreme competition mindset.
Really, really, really well said.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, I think I was just early in understanding business at the time you guys got into it.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't have like an understanding of how to act other than my natural instincts. And I think the natural instincts are to, you know, protect and defend,
mm-hmm.
and, you know, compete.
They're killer instincts.
Yeah, exactly. And because even to this day, you know, at this moment, I don't really give a shit about anybody in the competition space.
Mm-hmm.
I used to be a fucking nut about that shit. And I know both of you know.
Oh, yeah, we absolutely.
So I appreciate you still being here.
Yeah. We all learn.
What, Dan?
It's a collaboration.
Yeah. So here we are collaborating. But what I think is cool, and I love to give credit to the folks that have done this, is while there are some things I think we can go back into the past and go like, hey, that was like a super copy. You guys have totally found your own lane today. Mm-hmm. Like we're not even playing the same game.
No. And I,
not let alone in the same field, so, you know, competing.
So was the red and the teal teapots a super copy or not?
That was the ultimate super copy. But you got to imagine, we are 26 years old. We're trying to figure out where we fit into this competitive landscape.
Sure.
We see big people doing big things, you included. So it's hard not to want to emulate successful people.
Right.
So we're trying to find our footing, which you said earlier, it seems like we've found that lane and it's very different from where we started. So there's a lot of experimentation, a lot of figure out what do we do and what do people know us for and what do we want to be known for? And it takes a little trial and error when you first start out. So there was a little stepping on toes,
yeah,
and it's bound to happen. Not you alone. Like, I'm not even highlighting this. Other people too.
Sure.
There was, you know, you guys are right here where I am. What are you doing? You're right on my back, or you took this from me. We're trying to figure out our place, and you guys are all successful. So obviously we want to model some of the elements that make you successful.
You know, it was so funny is I remember standing while you were sitting at your desk at the OG Boakley Group office.
Post Road.
Yep. Yeah, Post Road.
Yeah.
And you basically said that same thing. And it's just funny to hear you say it or to remember you saying it then and my response inside,
mm-hmm.
and hearing it now and my response inside. And I'm almost like, I feel bad being like so aggressive a little bit.
But see, like,
that was the mindset at the time, though.
It was
for you, feast or famine, right? And these dudes are coming in and they're taking, you know, some of my kill, and it's going to upset you. But now I think that we learn, one, there's plenty to go around for everyone. Right?
That's the lesson I took from it. Is I looked, you know, I had this same mentality with Casey Ryan.
Mm-hmm.
we got into the business,
right.
Taught him the game, didn't work out. He went and fucking pissed all over me for, you know, a few months, and mm-hmm. it drove me fucking nuts. Mm-hmm. Thankfully today we're in a peaceful, happy place.
We're good.
But I didn't have that experience to see, like, my trolley keeps going. I didn't have that experience. I didn't have that memory to see that my trolley will always keep going because nobody is me. And so as I learned that from Casey, I learned that from you guys. I've learned it from I actually did the math. I counted 22 people that were considered close to the business mm-hmm. have come and gone since I started, like starting with Casey, Ryan, Kehlani, you know, all the way down.
Yeah. If you're like in a wagon, you've never experienced losing some of your supplies. So you probably freaked out the first one that went. Yeah,
there you sure. go.
Like, I'll sure. never get that back. And next right. you know, 20 things have flown off and you're still moving.
Right. There you go. So now I can carry that with me. So now competition doesn't really bother me. I'm like, dude, I've had fucking 25 people come and go in my life and my fucking trolley keeps ticking and yep. ticking and ticking. Right. So now, you know, the world is a lot more peaceful for me.
Good. I'm glad.
Even guys in the office, they'll say, like, I just got a new flip. I'm like, how? Like, MLS. And I'm like, what's the address? I'll get the address. I'm like, where the fuck?
Yeah, how did I not see that?
How did we not see that? And it's
a totally different product. And I'm like, you shit. So I'm like, it's amazing how everyone has their own lane.
Yeah, it's yeah. wild. Like, that was actually the one thing, you know, Casey and I have had many conversations, so I could say anything here candidly. The one thing that I always explain to him, I'm like, dude, I don't compete with anybody else in the fucking city. Mm-hmm. Like, I don't compete against Pineda. I'm not competing against Andre. I'm not competing against the Boakleys. But you seem to keep fucking showing up on my radar, dude. And that was when we, of course, he had to re-gear his business to make it so that wasn't happening. But it just seems like we all find a little bit of a lane and stay in it, and it works.
Yeah.
And Enzo's in everyone's lane.
Right. Yeah.
Always has been. Right?
Enzo.
I don't know if Enzo's in that high price point lane, though, which is nice.
He's not.
So we worked him out of there.
So let's talk about that. We'll move into that. So you sure. guys, what is your lane? You know, let's go into that. You describe, and then we'll go and talk in depth.
So I find that over the past few years, our lane is best described here in Las Vegas, for context, as luxury light. So there is luxury properties, but in your mind, my mind, those might be all different things. And even if I'm still talking about Vegas, luxury can be the $5 to $10 million Ridges, Ascaya. That's luxury. But those are a little bit too out of reach for a flip investment, at least for our lane.
Sure.
What we've found really good success in is just above that median price for Vegas, being the $400,000, $500,000, maybe even $600,000, upwards of $750,000 to like $2 million. Right in there, we call like luxury light. And it's working professionals, young families, people with good jobs, but they're not like super crazy wealthy people.
Sure.
They're not like $100 million guys that can buy a Summit house. So we found really good success in there. And I think it's appealed a lot to, as of recent, the California buyer that sells their two bedroom for $2 million
yeah.
and wants a really good product out here. Those price points, or the equity, the money they can take and place here, matches up really well. So that's kind of our successful lane, I guess, that we found ourselves in, is that luxury light. Does that make sense?
It's like totally. Entry level luxury.
It is. It is entry level luxury, and that's exactly the point. Is you sell $1 million house in California, it's 1,200 square feet. You buy $1 million house here, you could live in a country club on a sure. golf course.
Yeah,
you know, 3,000-4,000 square feet, fit a full family in it nicely. So it's huge.
Do you think that there is a market to flip? So what's your cap? Because you guys are, I mean, I'm a little bit shocked, frankly, to hear you call it luxury light. Because what's your most expensive listing right now? It's got a 3 in front.
$5 million.
Oh, five. Fuck.
$4,995.
I mean, how much? Okay. So you're talking like uber fucking wealthy, like 10 million plus.
That one.
That's not even, that's like in its own sphere. Oh, I get that.
And I'm not going to say our lane is that $5 million
no,
lane.
No, it's not.
We stepped out of our lane and tried something new and took on a challenge. Our lane is that like $1.5 to $1.7 million sale, where we buy them for $800,000, $900,000, maybe $1.1 million.
Got it. That's the sweet spot.
Yeah. Yep.
And that was always my sweet spot when I chose to flip that product. Right. It was like buy for $859,000, maybe $1 million and mm-hmm. sell for like $1.5 million.
Yeah. Yep.
Yeah.
But we also like that $500 buy, $750 resale, because it works out, you know, the hedge fund flippers like Enzo and everyone, those guys, and it works out entry-level flippers who don't have different funding sources to fund $500,000 to $700,000 purchases. So in my mind, that 5 to 750 range is really a good sweet spot because it outworks all the competition. There's not multiple offers,
sure,
which leaves us open to negotiating deeper margins with the sellers because they really don't have any other options.
Usually that's a dated product that requires a tremendous overhaul to make right. And right. Then, yeah, I could totally see that formula. Yeah, and you get rid of a lot of the riffraff. So do you guys even play in that lower space anymore?
We'll still send offers. We'll still get one every once in a while, but the competition's so much steeper.
Like, could you even imagine only making 20 grand on a house now?
There are some. Yeah, totally.
Like, that wouldn't ruin your whole day?
I was looking at our property log from the last 2 years.
Right.
And we surprisingly, like, in our minds, we're like, oh, we make, like, 75,000 plus on every house. Like, our average profit per deal was 70,000 the last 2 years.
Wow. Well,
but in
I could quote that.
In that mix, there are some $25,000 to $35,000 profit deals in there. I'm like, I forgot we did those little deals,
right. But intentionally, not that they didn't turn out well.
They were just like plug and play.
Okay. Yeah. Little
sold out list. So, you know, if they sold out list, you know, that's probably what we anticipated making. So
got it.
And those are always great deals to have in the hopper too.
I love those deals. That's my bread and butter.
Right.
You know, I always say this to Tyler Hubbs. I go, dude, you missed your calling. And I'm more than happy to say it to you too, as well. I might have even mentioned it. You guys could be custom home builders. Like, that's the calling.
Funny you say that, actually.
I really feel that way because some of the design that you guys are putting together is fucking, whether it's out of your brains or with collaboration of other, I don't even know how you guys do it, but special.
Yeah, we'll talk
and
about
the amount of work you're doing. I mean, fuck, it's might as well build a goddamn new home.
You might as well.
We'll talk about the importance of social media here in a few minutes because that point ties really well into it.
Really?
But I think that you bring up a good point on the budgets. You're so constrained at that lower price point. It's hard to do anything that's varying from the norm, what you've done before.
Sure, special.
You just really can't. You got to make it as nice as you can and replace with as many new things as you can, prioritizing that over style, trying to get the house all looking new again.
Right.
And so that's fine, and it does work. But when you have a $200,000, $300,000 budget, you can really take a step back and say, okay, like, what is the style of this house?
Yeah.
How do I select more specific materials to achieve that style versus just the same thing we had done before?
So is the renovation part of that funner or is it more stressful?
Way more fun.
It is. I assumed so, but I didn't know if maybe it was the opposite.
There's also the time constraint, like a $300,000, $400,000 house. We're trying to put that in 30 days.
Yeah.
But we have 2 months, 3 months to order stuff. It's okay if it comes in 3 weeks. It's fine. We don't need it for another 2 months.
Man.
We can select the right things that we want in the house.
What do you think, Dan?
I don't know. Is the process more fun or is it the final result?
I think both. Yeah. I truly think both. I mean, going to work, going into Red Rock, going into Anthem Country Club, that's our office.
Danny has a meltdown if we have more than like 5 homes east of the 15.
Oh, really?
I would too.
Well, I explain how flipping works is like it just varies from neighborhood to neighborhood at a lower price point. All of a sudden we're in the north and then it slowly moves east. And then right when we get to that area where it's DI and Nellis or Boulder, DI and Boulder, I hate it. It's like, it's so trash driving around there. It just puts me in a bad mood.
So I hate to even say trash. I'm going to just trump that just in case we get pinned to the wall for saying that. But
trash everywhere.
There is trash everywhere. I think what for me, and I've said it to Danny, I'm sure this is also what he's not wrong in saying trash. To me, it just represents lack everywhere. And I hate being surrounded by lack. You know, like I want to be surrounded by abundance, by big thinking. And it's just lack everywhere. Like that building hasn't been touched forever. The roads are all fucked up. The fucking, you know.
I saw a 2-story tent condo. He had like 2x4s. This was like 3 weeks ago.
That's kind of impressive.
It was. I was like, this dude needs to.
We should hire him.
When I was going around with Nick, he saw it. He's like, what the hell is that? I'm like, welcome to Nellis and Trop.
Dude, some people, it's funny. When we would like drag people down. You guys know this because you may not be doing it today, but you've done it. Drag people down to like the east side of town that like. Never been down there. They're like, dude, I didn't even know like this existed in Vegas.
It's insane.
Our dads call it a war zone, for lack of better terms.
That was better than trash.
Yeah.
Well, to his point, driving to
the
ridges and Red Rock, that's a lot better start to your day.
Exactly.
You're a little happier going to those houses and seeing the progress on those houses for sure. But
Those
areas of town make money, though, too. So, you know,
I mean,
as an investor, it's great.
Yeah, I think it's important to talk about both. You know, I think a lot of people aspire to go, hey, I want to, you know, they watch you guys. And it's easy to, because it's a glamorous space.
Sure, of course.
But they're forgetting that you flipped, I don't know, call it 200 homes. Don't quote me. East of the 15.
Yep.
Not to mention all the other homes you've
flipped. We cut our teeth
on
those areas of town and learned a lot before we decided to take this land.
So they're striving to go and take on this big luxury business. And it's like, there's nothing wrong with starting here and then working your way into that space.
Right.
That's how you do it, right? You gain the experience, you gain the confidence. You can't just go into a high-end luxury home as a new investor and expect to, really do well on that and make the best decisions possible on it. I mean, like you said, we flipped. You know, we just started getting into luxury the last 2 years. So before that, it was 250, 300 properties in those entry-level price points, in that entry-level space before we finally made that leap. And it was just a step out of our comfort zone to try to get to the next level. You know, we saw an opportunity. Margins were better. Competition was lighter. That was just what we naturally found in that space, which is why we went into it.
Sure.
You know, we could have easily said, hey, we're flipping 50 to 70 entry-level homes a year. Let's just stay here. You know, let's just be comfortable and stay here. But we decided to step out of our comfort zone. And that only came from confidence.
Yeah.
From experience.
Well, there you go.
And I think we had like this fundamental shift at how we looked at what we want from business, how we want to excel in business. We were thinking very linearly from when we started because they just didn't have any other way to think. So we wanted to flip 20, then we wanted to flip 50, and we're making X amount of dollars. We want to make double. Let's just flip 100. Let's just keep doing what we're doing. We'll just do more of it. But in my opinion, that's just working harder. So we tried to shift things and say, okay, can we, like the old saying goes, can we work smarter?
Sure.
And so we dropped the idea of I've got to flip 50 homes. I've got to flip 100 homes. The volume of homes no longer became important. It was, how can we make more money every year? If that happens to be with 10 homes or 15 homes and not 75, who really cares?
No.
We're making more money.
Oh, I'd rather flip one home and make $100 million.
I was going to say, I'd rather do 4 a year. They make $500,000 apiece, and that's our year, and that's a nice year to have.
You know, I'll own the opposite, and you guys deserve credit for what you've accomplished, but I'm going to be devil's advocate mainly because it's what I am. It's the business that I operate from. So I'm what you just described, and it could be considered old school thinking. I'm sure Danny probably, because Danny's a let's improve it guy at all times. Like, how do we make it better? How do we make it better? And I'm like, just what we've been doing is working. Like, let's just do more of it.
Yeah,
you know,
it broke, don't fix it, right?
Yeah. And the other thing is that Danny actually taught me about myself is that I was I had a special gift that I could keep all of it in my head. Like, I could have 54 homes and know what type of chandelier was going in every single one. I could tell you what flooring was going in every single one. I could tell you how much the price per square foot for each, tile that was going in.
Remember the addresses.
Remember all the addresses, everything. And what that did is that debilitated my ability to scale. Because I needed a team unless I was going to continue to live that crazy life, which I lived for about 3 years when I was flipping with your dads.
Mm-hmm.
When I was getting a smaller piece of the pot, I had to go do 123 homes, 111 homes, 118 homes in a year because I wasn't getting very much of the action. But so there was this time where I was like, just incredibly stressed out, not in a negative way. I probably was thriving on it actually, but just going. And then I was like, okay, I can't do this forever because one, it's probably going to kill me and that's not worth it. So I got to scale. And then how do I scale? Then I realized, holy shit, this whole time I've been doing it all in my head. So now I got to teach people. And that's actually where Danny's been so special in our business is he's made it so that we can scale, but it's still the old school thinking where it's like, let's just buy a house, make 25 grand and
do
another one.
100 more of them.
And do 100 more of them the best we can. But you got me thinking a little bit, what is the risk? There's got to be more risk. Otherwise, I could tell you right now, I would just switch gears and go and flip homes.
Of course.
Okay.
I think what we just experienced was the big risk, right? What happened that last 8 months was the risk. A shift in the market, we're dealing with a lot savvier people, a lot savvier buyers, financially understanding of what's going on in the market. They don't have as what it feels like as much of a need or demand to actually just have to go buy that house at full price or near list price. So, when we bought 22 million-dollar plus properties in April and May of last year.
28.
Holy mother of God.
I mean, yeah, there is a lot of, you know.
What was the average price per house?
$1 million.
Like 860
or something like that, or 825 was the average purchase for last year.
So, okay, because I thought that, and they've heard me describe it, because I get asked all the time, you know, people are, they see you guys or they see other people.
Sure.
And then they challenge me. Why aren't you flipping luxury? Why wouldn't I get, you know? And I always just say, you know, listen, I sell Italian food and I've sold Italian food forever. Just because a sushi restaurant down the street's fucking crushing it don't mean I'm going to start selling sushi.
Yeah.
It's just my space. But what I was saying is, and correct me if I'm wrong in understanding this, is that when interest rates were so much lower, it was almost like a free pass for a person that didn't have an experienced palate to walk into a luxury flip and see the price, the payment, and go, this is awesome. Mm-hmm. Okay. So, cause now let's just use easy math, you know, lower interest rates, $1 million home, $6,000 a month payment. Okay. A lot of people can swing that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, now all of a sudden that same $1 million house is $10,000 a month. Okay. Now the type of person that is earned, that is willing to contribute $10,000 of his income towards, a mortgage is probably a little bit more experienced, a little bit, has a more experienced palate, understands constructions, probably his 10th house instead of his third.
Yeah.
And then that's what you're up against, right? Is that what you're describing? That's what I'm understanding it to be.
Correct. In some form, that's part of the equation, where the people that we're talking about, these aren't ultra high net worth individuals, but they're higher net worth than your entry level or even median homes. These are the kinds of people you have to put yourself in their shoes. If they're buying this $1.5-2 million house, odds are they probably are an entrepreneur. They run a business, or they've done well and climbed the ranks of their business. They probably also have investments in the stock market and elsewhere. So when things turn, economy starts to shift, there's negative sentiment in the news, they hear that. Their stock portfolio might be hearing that. So it's not the fact that they don't have the money. It's that they choose not to spend the money in that moment when things change.
Yeah.
So it's a mentality shift of, I can buy this house, but I don't want to buy this house. Right.
All right. So you guys were able to work your way out of $22 million homes.
We did.
How many you got left?
We have two left. We have one. I should be getting an offer. I got a call right before this to, my clients love it. So hopefully
congratulations,
we nix that one off the books. And then we got the $5 million one.
Okay, let me ask you some questions on the $5 million one. Sure. This is honestly from an amateur's perspective, because I don't know your space.
Okay.
But I have like rules that I apply to my product that I buy. I looked at that house, just available.
Sure.
Is that a two-car?
No.
It's a two-car driveway, though.
It's a two-car driveway that branches out. So there's a single and then two doors. So it's deceiving from the street because it's a two-car cut on the curb.
Yeah.
You pull in, and then it widens up and goes to your three. So you have a single and two. But in that two, you have a depth garage as well.
Like a tandem for
a golf. It's a three-car?
So it's three and a half. I would say you could probably fit four cars in there.
Okay. Yeah. So when I saw that, I was like, oh, my gosh. Because I, at my all my with my taste in buying homes, I lived in a home with a two-car. I had a three-car. It was the two and the one.
Yeah.
But I had the two-car driveway.
Yeah.
And it fucking drove me mad.
Yeah. It's tight.
So and, I and told out of it. Yes. Dude, it was car roulette every morning.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You know, the wife's car, you know, and I always have a date car, I call it, a daily driver, and then a family car. And so playing that game, so I was like, I'll never buy a two-car driveway again.
You probably have four-car now, right?
I'm a three-car, but I have an RV gate on the side that I actually built like another driveway. So I actually drive I park my daily there.
Yeah.
And then.
So you don't have to play as much roulette.
Well,
in the Lambo in the garage.
Yeah, Lambo. Here's the crazy thing is, I have all this garage space and I'm talking about this, but my wife is like taking the two car all to herself and the kids. Yeah. And I have the golf cart separating us. So my side's like organized and shit. I got bikes hanging. I got like everything's organized and clean.
Hers kids open.
Dude,
doors.
You look at her side, bro. It's a fucking zoo. Yeah. It's crazy.
Well, Crystal called him today, or you called Crystal and you're like, where are my keys? I'm like, Crystal, why doesn't he have his keys? She's like, well, his car was behind me and I had to move it.
Move it.
You got four driveways.
I know. I do have four driveways. So yes, I have a four driveway, three car garage. So, okay. So that to me would have scared me from buying that house. Yeah, that one thing alone.
Once you opened the garage door, you actually saw the space. That was kind of alleviated.
Do you have a picture?
Probably not. The garage is open.
Dude,
not on my phone.
I'm telling you, we had a house like that. It was Meza. Do you remember Meza in Roma Hills?
A little before me.
Was that before you?
Yeah.
Okay, it was a two-car driveway and did exactly what you just described. It was like pie shape inside.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So I fucking pulled in my Audi at the time, my Porsche, and then Casey drove
his. Fill it with cars.
I filled it with cars.
That's a good idea.
And photographed it.
Nice.
To show what it could, what it represented.
Yeah.
Because that's a big.
I'm gonna take that idea.
No,
this
please.
This week,
show the
we're gonna relist it. So
yeah, go throw. You know, shit. Well, you can Photoshop my G's out, but I'll throw my Lambo in there if it helps you guys. But yeah, I think that's important because that's like huge, especially for a house that size.
Of course.
That was honestly, and then what I will say that I thought you guys absolutely crushed it on, is it was a very compartmentalized home.
Yeah.
Very, and I thought it was actually, because I live in, you saw my house.
Yeah.
Bro, you could be in the laundry room and just talk at this tone and I could be laying in my bed and hear you. So I'm almost going the other direction. The outside of like the coolness of having a wide open home, mm-hmm. bro, I almost am craving a little of that intimate,
privacy.
Compartmentalized, yeah. you know, dampening sound type living sure. experience. Anyway, so I saw you, I thought you guys fucking nailed that. Like you dialed each space really, really attractively.
Where's yeah. this house located?
Anthem Country Club.
Anthem Country Club. I think the two negatives about the house and
what are your negatives?
I wouldn't think that the garage I never thought as a negative. I think you had to
once
stand
we opened
in
it up, you realized okay, you could fit a lot of cars.
I get because you guys can see it though. Maybe, $5 million buyer. I got dude,
right.
I'm not a
you
five
might
million
want four or five cars.
Yeah.
Right. Exactly. I get it. So that makes a lot of sense. We haven't had pushback on that. What we have pushback on is small master closets.
Yeah.
And
secondaries are kind of
secondaries
small.
Are very small.
I never understood that.
Yeah.
Secondaries aren't small, but they're not oversized. They're very average secondary bedrooms.
Yeah.
I mean, you put kids in the secondary bedrooms either
exactly.
way. Who cares?
Like, I never understood that feedback.
We've had buyers walk from that, and it's like, you're putting kids in there. You're putting an 8-year-old in there.
Right.
Who cares?
Or buyers that don't even have kids.
Right.
And they're worried about how small their room
sure.
is. Why?
So the yeah. primary closets are a little bit small. We built them out nice, but they're not massive closets, which I think is a little bit of a downturn on the house. And then when you walk into a platform, and then there's steps down to the main area of the house, which, of course, the ups and the downs, some people don't like.
So. Yeah.
And that's a to each their own kind of thing.
Right.
Did you see the view?
The view is unbelievable. It's undeniable.
It's as good as it gets.
It's
really.
The greatest. Yeah. It's a Skya type view.
Yeah,
I think it's one of the best views in town. I mean, just the way it sits, it kind of, there's a mountain in front, like a hill to the right side of it too, where it blocks out that whole east side of town. So your view is literally like stratosphere and then all the beautiful mountainside of the town.
What did you guys take, strip view or mountain view?
I'll always take a mountain view. I've seen the city enough.
We did a poll.
It's not a pretty city. I'd probably rather take the mountain view too.
We did a poll in mountain view, like kilt city view.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, funny.
Nice golf course with the mountain behind it would be a nice view.
Yep. You know who taught me that? It was your dad. Phil taught me that. We bought a house in Red Rock. Mm-hmm. And it was, he goes, always take the mountain view is first what he said. And then it was a golf course. And then the back was mountain.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It was on Red Springs. You can kind of visualize that. It was the straight shot of the course and then the Red Rock mountain behind.
Just sold one on Red Springs.
Did you?
Yeah.
Did you get any kickback on the freeway?
Yeah, we had some people mention the freeway, and it's like there's this full one. You're on the opposite side of the street of the freeway.
I agree.
And there's a whole separation wall with a walking path on the side.
Right, dude. I got it.
I don't know.
I had to. That's where I learned about Sonos.
Yeah,
I put Sonos in the courtyard, in the house, in the backyard, everywhere, so that when buyers would walk in, they wouldn't hear the freeway. But I kept getting kickback from freeway noise.
Did you leave the Sonos as part of the house?
Yes, on accident.
On accident.
I went back, and all of a sudden, they were gone. All right, so tell me, what's your next plan? You guys, how's the rental game going?
It's going a little slow, honestly. I think...
Have you left Vegas?
No.
No.
That's why it's slow.
Yeah. It is hard to do here, isn't it?
I can't. Dude, I only, for like every five I buy out of state, I buy one here, and it's only in case the ones I buy out of state implode.
Mm-hmm. Really?
So that I don't sink. You
where,
know?
Where out of state have you gone?
I go to Missouri. Missouri, it's a town called St. Joe. I'm happy to tell people now because I got like 38 or 40 over there.
Wow. How many total?
I have 79 doors.
Okay.
79 doors and how to break that up. And I just call them doors for easy conversation. But for you guys and for the listeners, they probably want to hear and understand is this building alone it represents 7 doors.
Okay.
Because I have a cell tower. I have busy boots next door. So basically this building kicks off. Actually, technically it'd probably be... I've been wanting to get to 80, and I think I just realized I probably am at 80. Because when I bought the building, it was only netting me $7,000 a month. Mm-hmm. So I chopped it up into 7 doors, paying me $7,000 per door, $1,000 per door. But I just raised the rents in the back. I re-leased the back and I bumped it to 1500. So technically I could probably say 80, but I won't do that yet because I want 80 individual homes. Anyway, the building represents 7. I got 3 in Utah. I got like 30 something here. I can't even tell you. Honestly, I don't know the exact numbers, as embarrassing as that is. And I think I've got like 38 or 42, something like that, in St. Joe.
And all your first rentals when you first started building your portfolio was here.
Mm-hmm.
One of the harder places to do it.
Yes, but and that's what I always like to communicate to anybody listening, and obviously to you guys, is I had a, you know, it was a kind of a cool bragging right to be like, yeah, I got them in Vegas, you know,
yeah.
And you kind of rub it in a little bit. But then I was like, that's probably not the right approach, because the reality is that I got into it earlier. I had timing on my side. Yeah. I was able to go and buy single story 4-bedroom with a pool, 2-car garage on like Jones and Charleston for $109,000.
Yeah.
Like that's my most favorite one, because that's anymore. A real story.
How much do you net off that?
I don't know. My rent's $1,700 a month.
Yeah.
And the reason I don't know is I'd have to. So what ended up happening is I had like 35 homes here in Vegas. Call it 35. I got to fucking memorize these things. And I owned them all cash. I really did own them all cash. Maybe one or two had a loan on it, but all of them were basically cash. Then the pandemic hit.
Yeah.
So now the value, let's just for easy math, say the portfolio is worth $1 million. It's obviously worth more than that. And then it doubled. It went to 2 million. Well, my rents were still tucked in at the $1 million, you know, some of my rents were like 900, 1100 bucks a month.
Mm-hmm.
It was a disservice to the value of the portfolio to continue to collect that level of rent. It was like a 2.5% return, mm-hmm, based on the value, not what I bought it for, but based on the value. So then I said, the only responsible thing to do is to go and pull leverage.
Sure.
Learned a lot of lessons there. I'll share them with the room and anybody listening. One, I'm like, oh, I'm so afraid of leverage, mainly because what's funny too is, remember that our podcast,
yeah,
our last
podcast? Yeah, we talked about this.
Dude, and I was like,
over-leveraging.
Yeah, over-leveraging. And I was like, some big motherfuckers went down. I watched them happen.
That's
and
your Danny, biggest thing is you saw the big dogs fall.
Danny, hard. Thank you, Danny, because yeah, we've been friends since sixth grade. He was watching that circle fall. Guys we didn't think could go down
like
went down.
The kings of our lives.
Right.
You know, yeah, gambling 40, 50,000 a hand, just pure white death looks.
Cars just being like, towed off the driveway and then sticker being put on the front door.
They moving.
Their $5,000 mortgage just go and they're still living in it. And I'm like, you're squatting? I'm like, I never thought I would see these guys live that life. It was crazy to see.
Yeah, you got to witness it. And I did too. And that was one of the biggest blessings that I think's ever happened. But so being so afraid of leverage, I'm like, okay, let's strategically figure out how to pull money on each house. So I said, okay, what is the least amount of money that this house would rent for? And I'm like, okay, let's just use one house for an example. I'm like, this house in a terrible market would rent for $1,000 a month. So I was like, okay, we're going to pull the maximum amount of money to where the house always still cash flows. Mm-hmm. So that means that however much I can pull out, but the mortgage is $800 a month. So then I net 200. Then that way I never have to write a check to own the house.
Right.
AKA what I call, I end up hating the house, because it's easy to end up hating real estate if you have to write a check to own it.
Sure.
And which we all just recently went through. They're like Lyndhurst. Fucking hated Lyndhurst.
Yeah, that was a piece
and
of
Sierra Oaks. Oh, and Black Pine.
We have a couple we hate.
I hated the last 8 months.
We were writing checks to fucking own real estate.
Holy hell. Ever heard of a 900 square foot condo named Casey? Not Casey. It was what was the one over there?
Mission Hills.
Mission? No, not Mission Hills.
Which one?
Mission Carmel.
Mission Carmel.
Oh.
Fuck. Lost 20 grand on that.
Little condo?
Yeah.
Little shit condo. Yeah. Anyway, yeah, I fucking hated that one too.
So you're pulling out 50%, 60%?
No. So the formula I just did is what I just described. Yeah. What is this thing going to rent for in the worst market possible? How do I keep the mortgage below that? Okay, because this is actually the wrong thing. I'm going to get to it. This is all wrong.
This is a mistake.
This is a mistake.
Okay.
That's why I want to go through it. So now the mortgage on this is $800, whatever it spits out, called 120 grand at the time, because it was like 2.3% interest rates, believe it or not, on a cash out refi. Okay, now I own this house, right? Well, the house is worth 350 and I pulled out 160.
Okay.
Well, what do I do with the rest of that equity? I can't tap it because I'd have to forego my amazing interest rate. Yeah. And then I went and did that on like 7 or 8 homes.
Okay.
So now I trapped that extra equity in that property, or trapped, assuming I don't want to let go of that low interest rate. So if I'm like, okay, I want the rest of the equity, then I got to refi the whole thing out.
Yeah.
So what I should have done is I should have taken three homes and maxed them out to 80, 90%.
Instead of less homes with less.
Less home with less.
Oh, okay.
So big lesson for whoever that wants to take it and use it. What I did to overcome that, but talk about a lesson I wish I would have known at the time, is I went and got lines of credit on everything. And actually, there's an argument that that may have gone a little bit more my way. But if I could redo it, I would definitely have taken 10 homes, maxed them out 100%, and left the rest cash and gotten lines of credit on the ones cash. Because you don't ever think about what happens when you get that money. Now it's trapped.
Yeah.
And then if you go do another refi, you're like, well, now I'm in a 6.5-7% interest rate. So that was a big lesson I learned there. But basically, so I took that money and I went to St. Joe. And I started buying out there, earning 12% cash on cash.
What is the buy box out there? If we wanted to go to St. Joe and buy a rental, what does that formula look like?
First of all, and I'm not just saying this to toot my own horn or to drive business my direction, I would 100% encourage you to go through me. Because if you buy a home on the other side of the road, your rent goes from a high demand with a line to be rented from $8 to $1,000 a month to zero line. If you're lucky, you get $500 a month. And it happens because a good friend of mine, I was telling him about St. Joe, just shooting the shit, and he got excited and he ran out there and he comes back to me next time I see him and he's like, dude, I bought two houses.
I'm negative on everything.
And he can't rent them. Yeah. I'm like, bro, you did. Now when I say St. Joe, I have to disclose that so that people don't come back and go, this is the worst place I've ever bought a real estate.
How did you learn which side of the freeway to be on?
I got really lucky with my property management out there.
Okay.
These girls are crushing it. They're making they got 400 homes. Okay. And you got to think, what does it cost to live out there? Nothing. So these girls are living the life. Mm-hmm. All of their 400 homes are in neighborhoods that they would take their children to go and do a swap of the tenant or hand off keys or put a lockbox on. So they feel safe and they only take homes that feel safe. So now they have homes that are of quality. The tenants are of quality. And now when I secure a property, I send it to them. And if they say, I'm not going to property manage that, then it's gone. I don't buy it. Yeah. So that's really been my savior out there. The other funny thing that is interesting to understand about buying homes outside of Vegas is if we're buying a Spring Valley home built in 1970, right? Mm-hmm. The average life expectancy of all of its mechanics, arguably, or they say 30 years, we're probably getting 40 or 50 out of a lot of them. We're getting close to the point where we might have to do a rewire. We might have to do a new roof. We might have to do
older homes.
Yeah. Okay. So my homes out in St. Joe are 120 years old.
Right.
But they've been scrubbed. So I'm buying them when they've already got brand new windows, vinyl windows, new siding, new roofs, new HVAC.
Full remediation on all the mechanicals.
Everything. Dude, literally, you go look at the MLS photos, and it's a brand new breaker box, a brand new pipes, brand new water heater. So I'm actually buying newer homes in St. Joe than I believe I'm buying in Vegas. And let me just make sure I answer your question, but don't lose your thought.
Yeah.
So I like to buy I just bought six units out there at $35,000 a door.
Wow. New?
Yeah. One was a fourplex and one was a duplex.
Okay.
So take that into account. And yes, all the same new shit, new doors, new vinyl, everything's new. The building's 120 years old, but mechanically speaking, everything.
So you're not remodeling yourself.
I don't touch any construction out there.
Okay.
Nothing. And I would encourage you guys, if you decide to go out there, do not buy anything that has construction, which is why that market cannot appreciate. If guys like you and I, if we want to have a great business idea, we could develop it sitting right here. Let's go start a construction company in St. Joe. We will buy every single thing for $60,000 to $80,000. And then all of a sudden, when a buyer walks in and they go, oh my God, look at that shiplap. Look at that backsplash. This is a functional floor plan. They'll go, I'll pay an extra 10 or 15 for this. And that's the problem. Because there's no construction industry out there, zero, to get a baseboard painted takes 2 weeks.
Yeah.
Because there's no construction industry, these homes can't tap into the emotional component of buyers. They're a function. They're not a need or a desire or an emotional reaction.
Low appreciation.
Almost zero. Well, I think that I think I got into St. Joe at the right time. So yes, I experienced a little appreciation. I bought my portfolio at the time that I own more now, but I was into it at 1.1. I went and got a line of credit on all of that. And it came back at 1.4 million. So yes, but it's not an appreciation play.
Right.
And honestly, I don't believe in appreciation necessarily. Of course I believe in it. I care more about cash flow, but I'm never going to sell.
Mm-hmm.
There's too many advantages to keeping and holding and never selling.
Right.
I'm sorry, Landon, what was your question? I was rambling over you.
I was going to ask how much you pay on average per door. So you said 35,000.
So that was a unique scenario. And I wanted to give that as like a teaser, funny, entertaining, you know, wow, shock value. But I've also paid $72,000 for a 3-bedroom, 2-bath. So you wouldn't want to spend more than 70.
That's still very affordable. I mean, you can't buy a rental in Las Vegas for under 300 pretty much. I mean, you got to get
worth
it.
Worth buying.
Right, worth buying. You know, and to even buy, you know, buy something that needs work done to it, you're still at 200.
Right.
220.
Right.
Yeah. So, I mean.
Yeah. And I'm always, I think I'm still a little programmed on like the old school rents out here. Like I just bought one over on DI and Nellis. On DI and Nellis. It's on a road called Colbath. 2,000 square foot house, you know, rent ready. Dude, I got $2,000 a month. So. I think
and
a little
Section 8, right?
And Section 8. Yeah.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. You have Section 8 tenant in it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So guaranteed, you know,
get a little more than
top market rent.
Yeah. You get a little bit more.
Yeah. Like, why
not? Yep. Top market guaranteed rent. My point in saying that was, is I think a little bit of our minds, and I'm not practicing it perfectly by any stretch, is that we're a little bit stuck in when we look at that little single story two car with a 3-bedroom shingle roof, you know, siding. We're like, what's that thing worth? $1,500 a month?
Right.
If you actually bought it and listed it, dude, you'd probably get like, $2,100 a month. Like Matt's house, dude, that's like $2,000 a month.
Yeah.
And he's sitting in there for $1,640.
Yeah, it's changed.
Yeah.
It continues
but
to
we're,
change.
But we're not, I'm not keeping up with it enough to dive back into Vegas. And it's really difficult when you're buying fucking.
Well, he was a little spoiled. There was this house called Signet. It was 2018. Just lands in his lap. It's like a 2-bedroom, 2-bath, stucco finish, 2 cars, tile roof for $100K.
Nice.
Oh.
100 grand.
Easy deal.
He rented it in.
That's 2008 seconds. Type deal.
Yeah. Tenant's still been there.
Yeah.
Yeah. Amazing.
See, like that little house is worth like 315. Yeah. It's crazy.
Those are awesome.
Do you have any natural disaster problems in those areas?
No. Great question. No. So I went to Mississippi and I started out there. And that last hurricane came through and I was renting a house for like $750 a month and my insurance went to $375. My house didn't even get touched.
Yeah, really?
Yeah, so you could just do the math on that.
You were on the coast, right?
What's that?
You were by the coast.
I was in Gulfport, so near the coast. Yeah. I didn't get touched, but my insurance skyrocketed. Right.
So you just have winter to worry about now.
Yes, exactly. So no, there's no, that's the other thing. When you go to buy these homes, you don't want to deal with natural disasters, tornadoes and hurricanes and earthquakes. I don't even know what the fuck else there is.
Yeah, because we've looked at Florida a few times, but they're like, all right, well, you got to replace a roof after a hurricane and you got to get hurricane-proof windows and you got to upgrade all these things in the house. And it's like, okay, well, now it's not worth the investment.
You know? Yeah.
Now we're pricing ourselves out of the remodel, out of the investment. It doesn't make sense anymore.
It's a tough game. I love my little St. Joe, you know, but outside of that, you know, it's tough for me to tell you go buy a house in Vegas. Like that's hard, you know, unless your motive isn't just cash flow and it's principal pay down long. The other thing that I learned too is actually I want to reverse a little bit of this, but a lot of this stuff is thought versus practice. That's why I kind of hesitate, meaning I don't know if I actually do it personally, but I understand it. What I did experience is, and this is what has elevated my life so dramatically. People are like, man, you're doing really good. It's like, well, what ended up happening is year one of owning rentals is okay. Year two is okay. Year three, your payment's still $600 on the rental, but now your rent went from $1,100 to $1,700. And then think about what happened to me in the pandemic. My rents were like $1,100 a month on average. And finally, all of my leases reset on like 30 something homes jumped like $700 a month.
Nice. Nice.
You know, and then I bought that crazy ass cabin in Bryanhead, which turned out to be, it wasn't even meant to be an Airbnb, but
now it is.
You have it still?
Oh, yeah.
He
was very stern. He's like, I am not. First, he's like, I'm going to only Airbnb this one and keep my townhouse.
Yeah.
And he goes and sees the big mansion out there and he's like, damn, I'm going to do a couple things to it. And then he starts putting his personal touches on that. He's like, all right, I'm going to Airbnb the townhouse.
Yeah.
I'm going to live
this
in here.
This one's for me.
And then, on just a whim, he's like, let me see if I can get, what was it, $1,000?
My neighbor
a night?
Told me, I met my neighbor up there. They said they were getting $480 a night. And so we were getting ready to leave, as we always do, and not come back till, because the kids go back to school in the winter. And the neighbor, Chris goes, do you want to put it up? I go, if they want it, it's $1,000 a night. And then
he gets a
just
booking.
Rolling.
Well, he gets a booking for the New Year's Eve when he's normally up there, $6,000.
Yeah.
Wow.
Oh, but it was, November was like, 50% booked. December was 100% booked. January is 100% booked. February was basically 100% booked.
Nice.
Yeah, so that thing has been really good to me too.
So 78 rentals, is that your only Airbnb?
79.
79, sorry.
is that your most profitable door?
Yeah, man.
It's gotta be.
Well, you know, the payment on $7,500 a month, so don't fool yourself there. And then because I don't have an HOA, I got snow removal, which this was a crazy snow year.
It was.
So I spent probably $800 to $1,000 a month in snow removal. And then you got, you know, it's a five bedroom that can hold like 20 people. So one booking can take 30 rolls of toilet paper.
Sure.
Yeah.
I was just talking to Danny about that. He's like, no, it can happen. I'm like, what, dude? Who fucking uses that much toilet paper?
We've had a couple over the last few years here in Vegas, actually, and kind of deciding whether we want to keep them now with the regulation and how that's rolling out, whether we just want to deploy it into another city. But we tried to focus on Airbnb in the luxury light, where they're non-HOA, but they're still $1 million, $1.2 million property, seven bedrooms, decked out the backyards. And for those, here in Vegas even, we could get $750 to $1,000 a night.
Wow.
For those, so those did really well.
And those you still have?
We have a couple of those still.
Yeah. And what's going to happen with, go ahead.
We don't know what's going to happen with them. You know, the regulations are crazy, but we just signed an Airbnb arbitrage deal too. Have you heard of that?
I know what it is, but go ahead, fill me in. So no, I have no idea. Tell me.
Right. Airbnb arbitrage, where we as corporate tenants went to the landlord and said, hey, would you be willing to sign a lease with corporate tenants? It's going to be a 3 to 5 year lease. We ended up signing a two-year lease with an option to extend for a year.
Oh, my God. With them. You guys got balls this big.
With full disclosure that we're going to market this for short-term rental use. And that includes, you know, traveling nurses. That includes insurance uses. And that includes marketing it and using it on Airbnb as well. So full disclosure as to what the property is going to be used for.
But we built in outs.
We built an out with the regulation. So if there's any...
If we get flagged.
City knocks on our door, it's an immediate 30-day to vacate with no penalty.
Wow.
We're not on the hook for the 2 years.
Who is this renter? Why was he so open to this new concept?
The landlord. I think they were kind of just struggling. It's kind of a house where it's like...
It was already flipped.
It was flipped. It's renovated, but I don't think it's super, super desirable for somebody to necessarily live there or rent that like as their primary residence. So I think he was having a little trouble leasing it for a little while, and he was open to hearing what we had to say.
Did you offer a little more than market?
10%.
Yeah.
Dude, this is a total win.
Yeah.
So, you know why I love that it's a win?
Marketing
is full disclosure.
Yeah. Full disclosure and full contingencies. If something happens with the regulations, we're out. So what? It costs us $15,000 in furniture to set it up.
You might be the first ones I've ever heard do it the right way. So congratulations.
Thanks.
We heard from another very experienced party. We didn't invent this. So I got to give credit.
But you executed it. You deserve credit there, man.
We just threw shit against the wall and it stuck.
What's the security deposit?
Just 1 month's rent.
Yeah. That's it?
Yeah.
Jeez.
So $3,300 a month in rent. They were marketed at $3,000. It's in downtown. It was already flipped. The benefits of it was five bedrooms already. So a five-bedroom house.
Four and a half.
So it could sleep 10-plus people.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
It has a pool and a spa, and it has a big open living room with a kitchen open to it as well. So big open space for a lot of people to come in and hang out at. So we saw a lot of benefits with the actual layout of the house, which is super important. So $3,300 a month, we put it on last week, and I think we're fully booked for the next couple months.
Yeah. No way.
We got a booking within a week.
Oh, my God. Ready
to go. It's like 3 minutes from the Stratosphere, so it's like very close to the Strip.
Is it 7th Street?
It's not 7th.
Okay. No. We didn't have five bedrooms.
I remember that 7th Street house.
Do you remember it?
A little like turret in the middle.
Yeah. Good memory, man.
Yeah.
Do you think in pictures?
Always.
Do you think in pictures?
Incredibly visual.
I think in pictures, but I'm like you, though. I remember like every address we have, all the materials going into it, all the numbers on it, like that, my mind's always going around our properties.
So your ability to memorize those things, though, like when I think I'm going to relate more with you, but I like is if when I was memorizing those things, like a price per square foot for tile, it wasn't like I remember it in the spreadsheet.
It was the sticker on the tile.
Yeah.
I have a screenshot. So then do you?
I am not an analytical guy at all. Like, I am not a spreadsheet guy. Like, I just remember things. Yeah, I guess I'm photo-based memory.
So, because like when you came over to the house the other day, which is a real blessing, and that was kind of cool to interact with you over there. Like, when I recall that conversation, it wasn't the contents of the conversation. It's like I could see my backyard. I could see you sitting at the table. I could see the grade table. Like, that is how my brain memorizes things. It's just photos. The reason I always ask that, though, to like investor guys or even entrepreneurs is I feel like that is a character trait that is super special in the entrepreneurial space, because a lot of what I've experienced, entrepreneurs think in pictures.
Yeah.
They have photographic memories.
They think in vision too. They have the vision.
Right.
I think
we can see it.
Like when we walk into a flip, yeah, go ahead.
That visual nature of walking through a house and what we have to do to a house, most people don't have.
Yeah.
Where the walls are still there, the old stuff's still there, and I have to see what it's going to be. That visual nature allows us to see the end product before we've even started.
So what's your yin and
you can really do the same, right? Like you walk in, like we walk into our flips and do tours on our flips all the time with students, and they're like, how do you know what's going to happen here? And it's like, I could walk in through the front door and instantly see everything in the house already completed.
Yeah.
You're probably the same way.
100%. I go walk in and go, okay, there's a coat closet on the right. Keep going. Then it's, you got the bedroom on the left about six steps in. I could draw a whole house in my brain.
Right. Yeah. Right.
Completed, done, you know, even how it's going to be staged and furnished and photos, pictures on the wall and everything. It's,
yeah.
You know, that's just what we have.
Yeah.
But we stop at staging. we get the walls out of there.
Guys are do you guys still stage it? Well, of course you still stage.
We do.
You're doing
everything.
You guys were staging the $250,000
everything.
We've just decided
to be a value every time.
Incredibly. Yeah. There was a pivotal point where we decided, let's do it. We're gonna run an experiment. And we did it for like 25 houses.
You did one on Lynn Lane. It was like a $90,000 house. I'm like, yes. You're even staging fucking
everything.
Yeah, absolutely.
When you commit, then you don't have to think about it. Because for us, we're like, well, should we? And then there's a conversation every time. You guys said every time we stage.
Well, we measured it.
It was an experiment up front. So we're like, okay, for the rest of this year, we finished out maybe 25 houses, Lynn included. Let's try this and see how it goes. We found a great stager. He's going to do this fairly affordably. It's not going to break the bank by any means to put some furniture in there and try it. So we tried it all. And then at the end of the year, recap our numbers. We go on year by year by year always. We always look at, as our dads taught us, look at everything in a year scope, not super micro.
Sure.
So we could see our average purchase, our average sale, our average profit. What did we do? And we just saw year to year, the purchase price, the renovation, the sales were basically the same that year from the year prior to that year. But the difference was staging. And we sold like 98.7% of what we were asking for, which is a very big difference from the year before. So is the impression.
How about days on market?
Yeah, with an average days on market of like 17 days on market.
Yeah.
Across very low. Houses, so
it worked out. And then from then on, it was less not
stage at all. Well, dude, we should own that guy's staging company, by the way.
What is affordable
the warehouse
staging?
I've thought about doing it.
Yeah.
What's affordable staging? Like Lynn.
Lynn Lane. So back then, we could stage an entire place that's master bedroom, living, kitchen, dining, like we call it a three-quarter stage of the entire house for like $1,300. And that includes the first month's rent.
Yeah. So that's drop off, install, 30 days.
Is this Thomas?
Yeah.
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 I found Thomas as soon as he started his business. He basically opened his doors.
We should own his business.
We called him.
You guys have probably given him so much.
So we had a long conversation with him today, and he was just like so grateful. We used to have this thing called legacy pricing with him because of how many referrals and how much his business has built off of us. And he still acknowledges it. He goes, you guys absolutely changed my life.
Do you guys find that on that token, what a special thing that he has the ability to express, do you express gratitude?
100%. That was the entire
phone. Do you operate from that space?
I try to as much as I can, always.
Are you vocal about it?
I try to be more. Yeah, it's probably something that's a
practice. About you, Landon?
From a space of gratitude?
Yeah, like are you the guy that's like, hey, I really appreciate you guys did that?
I build good relationships with people, but I don't think I practice gratitude as good as I could.
Just interesting. I found it to be like I like it because it makes me feel good.
Right.
But
I've always done it.
I think I became aware of me doing it. Mm-hmm. And then of course I doubled down on it. I think my love language is like words of affirmation. You know, I think that's what it is. An acts of service. I don't know. But to me, I like that. So I would obviously been trying to deliver what I like to everybody around me, whether or not they like that. But what I ended up realizing is that it got me a lot more yeses. It got me a lot more of what I liked. You know, like if I wanted something, then and I go, hey, man, that was really cool that you did that. Now you get more of it because they're like, well, I want to get everybody wants to please people and make everybody happy, you know, when possible. But I just thought I took that right. The fact that Thomas has grown his business as successfully as he has and he looks back at you guys and goes, thanks.
Yeah. We still talk about
like
that.
That's special.
Yeah.
You know,
of course.
Yeah.
He barely had enough furniture to stage like three houses at a time.
Right.
Now he's doing.
Right.
You know,
every
I could tell when
town.
He was out of furniture because we'd get some pieces. We're like,
I know,
dude. One time, this is how gangster Danny is we had a house I couldn't sell and we didn't stage it. So, or we had a house, that we needed to stage, but we had another house that was under contract. Mm-hmm. So he takes the work van, fucking piles up all of Thomas's
shit,
drives it to the other house, lays it all out.
I mean, that's what Thomas does.
And then, really?
It's, I mean, no, that close.
Right. But I also had to push it back because that house was under contract. So I'm like, fuck it, let's go over here. So I moved it over here, took photos. And by the time that one was supposed to close, I had to move it back there and tell Thomas, hey, come get your shit.
Right. Yeah, it's
Thomas, if you're listening.
Yeah.
This is 3-4 years.
We love you, Thomas.
Dude, I'm so careful with this shit because he takes visual inventory on all of his stuff.
He does.
He takes such good care of it.
We've had some squatters break into the house and have some fun in our houses, and oh, he notices it right away.
Really?
Like, hey, you got to buy me new sheets. We're like, damn it. Dirty Mike and the boys, you know, got back into the house.
Oh, no. Gosh. So when I'm looking at you two,
sure.
I don't see a yin and yang. I do because I kind of know you guys, but hearing what you just described about like how you guys think and process information and stuff, mm-hmm. what is your yin and yang?
Well, I always wear white. He always wears black.
Yeah. Really?
Honestly, it happens more days than it doesn't.
I always wear black. We've taken like PI tests, personality tests, and we are very drastically different from one another. You know, if we looked at it in what would be considered like maybe the business sense, I'm more the visionary, he's more the integrator, a lot more analytical, a lot more careful with his decisions, a lot more sit back and let me review things. I'm more of the, let's just go. I push a lot. You know, I'm out creating new relationships a lot, and he's more careful, analytical. Okay, you put this together, let me make sure we do it right. Let me make sure that we make it happen correctly, because me, you know, I'm not going to read a document. I'm just going to sign it and send it. Like,
and you're the guy that makes.
Hey, I met this guy that, you know, wants to fund some of our deals. He said he's got $600,000. Awesome, boom. Let me get his info. Let me send him proposals. Let me send him wiring instructions. Now we're using the funds. How are we going to use the funds? Where are they going to go? How are we going to account for it? Now let's put it in play.
It's a beautiful thing.
Yeah,
sounds like you guys are yin and yang.
Yeah, I think that, you know, in the past we still do it, and I think it's just something that we're trying to work on it all the time. Where we don't want to both be doing the same thing all the time, because I don't think there's a good use of either of our times if we're both doing the same thing all the time. So we're trying to get away from that, but we like doing a lot of the same things as well. You know, designing the houses, dealing with the construction man. It's like, we don't need two people to go do that, but we both want to do that. So we're always trying to battle with what is most important, what's the best use of our time, how do we split, divide, and conquer tasks when we both want to be doing that task, you know, in a sense. So I think that's the hardest part of it all.
I totally agree. Yeah.
We start new things too, like new endeavors or a new business, and it's new to both of us. So it's important that we both understand it.
Sure.
We both learn it, but then it kind of leans one way or the other.
Right.
We start to naturally see the chips fall and where the responsibilities find each other.
You guys ever had that really hard conversation?
Which one?
Just about like business together.
A ton of them.
The one?
There's always one where it's just like, what the fuck are we doing? Like,
oh, we've had a couple of those for sure. Yeah.
I was going to go there next. It's kind of funny to say that. Danny and I think we purge every 90 days.
That's
where we sit down and we just, not even intentionally. I think we just.
There's a moment.
Yeah.
It just happens.
And it's been super healthy for the relationship to be able to go, okay, what are we doing right? What are we doing wrong? What's working? What's not? And it's not scheduled, but like just being in a partnership isn't easy.
No,
and you've already gone through a bad partnership. So what was different? What's the difference of the two partnerships?
Well,
what did you learn? What did you do differently?
For me, I'm aware of who he is.
Right.
Like
right.
I'm a prideful dude. I'm an alpha dude, but I also have the ability to go back and let someone else take over. If Josh isn't around, I do the same shit Josh does. I move furniture for the family. I get all the shit going. But when he's there, he's so aggressive with it. I'm like, cool, I'm your support.
Let him do it. Yeah.
So a lot of people, when they work with people like this, the red personality is they take offense to the things they do and how they lead. And you just have to understand that they're just trying to complete their goal. And they'll mush you, smash you into the wall. They'll mash everyone in the wall to get the goal done. The good thing about Josh is he always comes back and he picks up the piece and says, hey, you know, we got there, but how are we all doing? He's very aware. So for me, I can get yelled at. I can get scolded. And if I realize I was fucking up, I can be like, you know, he's right. If I'm not, I'll vocalize myself. And he's the first to be like, oh, you're right.
Yep.
Sure.
So it's just you have to understand who's the aggressor, who's the motor, and that's Josh. And I don't mind being the wheels to his motor or the windows. That's fine for me. And it just takes someone like that to actually realize it. And I see partnerships around our office that have failed, and it's usually because the communication and the ability to not feel each other out or let someone lead it kind of leads to that. And that's, for me, I just very aware that it's his system. He's the motor. Let me just compliment where I can.
What I don't understand with partnerships, because I'm listening to Danny say all that, and he's saying, I'm okay being this. What that's on the surface, but Danny's very proud and proud to be this. And that's where I think people fuck up in partnerships, is instead of them looking at, like, and understanding it, to your point, that that is his role. That's what he's good at. That's what makes this thing work. Instead of just looking at him and going, that guy gets all the credit, they're also going, without me, this thing doesn't work, and I'm proud of my space and my contribution to this thing. Mm-hmm. A lot of people can't do that. They instead diminish. If they're not number one, then they're like number 20. So that was a big issue with Casey, is Casey couldn't, and we have to give ourselves both a pass here that we were both very new in business.
Sure.
He was extremely new.
Right.
I was relatively new. He couldn't understand, like, it was like number one, and he was like,
right
here, number two. And I even vocalized that, because he'd want to come in and share the same, you know, share the same space. And it's like, no, bro, this is my space. You have your space. And he couldn't look at his space and go, you know what? This is my space, and I'm fucking proud of it. Mm-hmm. And without me, that wouldn't work, you know? And instead he kept taking it as, I'm just not number one. And I think this is great conversation for people listening that are in partnerships. And at this point, I don't even think it's about number one or two. I think Danny just understands that the infrastructure was here, and arguably, you know, we're equal at this point. It's not even, but if somebody has to lead, you've got to be a good Indian, and you got to be both. And there's times where Danny's made decisions where I'm like, I'm going to be an Indian. And actually there's lots of times that are that way. You know, Danny's in charge of all the social media. He's in charge of the graphics. He's in charge of, you know, modernizing this whole flipping business. Now imagine if my ego got in the way and I was like, you know, what if that takes some credit away from me? And then I, you know, squash it. I could tell you right now, Galindo Group Real Estate wouldn't be what it is.
Yeah.
100%. The greatest thing that Casey ever gave me was by leaving, was having Danny step up, because Galindo Group Real Estate would have just been an investment business. That's all it would have been. Mm-hmm. It just would have been a brokerage that flips homes.
Yeah.
But Danny brought to the table, what he brought was the ability for me to take my visions and him communicate it to the world.
Create
Does
a
that
brand.
Make sense?
Create a brand. Something to share.
He could create it.
Yeah.
It was this that thought it. And then that's what I think we have that special. I can go, Danny, this is my vision. And he's like,
yeah.
And it's like, oh my God, it's even cooler than I thought.
Yeah.
And then now we could go communicate with the world. So that was the greatest gift that I got. But I'm always just curious of people's partnerships and dynamics. And you know,
funny people, girls that we've known in high school, I was at, I think, one of Talia's parties. And they were like, what's up with Josh? He's so cocky on social media. And they just keep going on. I'm like, he just says words. I film it. I post it. You know,
I run all this.
You build
I build it.
You're the ego behind it all.
I'm like, yeah, like, you're pretty much talking shit about me. But it's like, if I had any ego, like, I'm putting all this energy to make Josh this big. It's like, no, I want Josh to be big.
Yeah,
I want to put my energy and effort into it and all my expertise. Because the bigger he gets, the bigger I get.
Right.
You see that?
For sure.
And that's why I'm always talking about attaching my team to production. Like, I had a team of 11 was the real number. And they were all attached to production too. But I didn't like managing that many people. I'd rather consolidate all of the money and have 5 people and have all of them absolutely crush it. Mm-hmm. With, you know, the ability to improve their lives. Like, I don't want people that have resentment going to work, that don't like work, that don't own their workspace. So I'm like, dude, when I'm crushing it, you're crushing it. Now, here's the flip side. When I'm not crushing it, I don't have any stress, because there ain't no money going out. You know, it's not like that's the people forget about that part. You know, like, I don't want to share the profit. Well, what if things get slow and now all of a sudden you have to keep writing that check for $7,000 a month, sure, that you're paying?
Now you're down to a salary versus a production.
Right.
Yeah.
Sure. Yeah.
We do that a lot with our team as well.
Yeah.
We only have one person, which is our office admin, on a salary. Everyone else is production based.
They eat what they kill.
Yep.
Yep. And it makes them hungrier, more motivated. Yeah.
Construction managers, you're paid based off profits per deal, and the more we make,
oh, managers, yeah,
not on an equity percentage, but you get paid out of, you know, when we sell a house, that's when you get paid.
Yeah,
On the construction management side, and you know, if they do a great job, obviously we're going to reward you more. We're going to bonus you. We're going to make sure everyone's happy on those jobs. But if those jobs go over timeline and we're over budget and problems arise, it affects all of us,
yeah,
including them.
Yeah. Totally. Yeah.
But you segued nicely into social media and how that's changed and how that's delegated now. And how has that really affected your flipping business?
Brokerage aside,
like obviously it's.
Well, you know, so this, I'll tell you the reason that I Am Josh Glinda was born is not for the money. I don't, frankly speaking, call it cocky if you want. I don't need the money. I don't, all it would do is go to buying more rentals. It wouldn't enhance my life.
Mm-hmm.
So I said this year, Danny, because I want to keep seeing Danny progress in his world. And that's the important part about being a leader is when things are great, you get all the credit. When things are bad, you get blamed. So you got to be conscious of that.
Yeah.
So to me, I'm like, every one of my team members has to keep growing. Like, I don't want anybody stagnant. If you made $100,000 last year, you got to make $120,000 this year.
Yeah.
You know, if you made $120,000, you got to make $140,000. And so anyway, how do I get Danny to continue to progress in his career? And I was like, you got to give more responsibility. So basically, Danny runs the housing business. He's identifying flips on his own. He's putting together construction budgets. He's designing them on his own. And then he's getting them ready to be listed. And I'm here to as a support system. So I put Danny in charge of flipping. I put Heather and Matt in charge of retail. I put Jaden and Danny in charge of consulting. I put Nick and Crystal in charge of the rental portfolio.
Mm-hmm.
So Nick's in charge of Missouri. Crystal manages Las Vegas and right. The Airbnbs.
Mm-hmm.
So it left me without a job.
Perfect.
So then Danny's like, you know, let's fucking blow you up. You're as real as it gets. You're just not showing people on social that you're that real. And we had this conversation. I actually took it as a big compliment, whether it was intended that way or not. But Landon's like, yeah, you came out of nowhere. Like, I don't think I realized that you were like where you're at. And because I didn't have it all over the social, but there's no, anyway, so we thought it was a good fit. So now where does that leave us today? What I've learned, I have a tremendous amount of respect for you two. I have a tremendous amount of respect for Ryan Pineda. I have a tremendous amount of respect for Troy Kearns.
Mm-hmm.
In the social media space.
Right.
That is a new animal for me. It's expensive.
Very.
It's time consuming.
Very time consuming.
You know, I remember thinking when we were building our video bankroll, and Danny's back there fucking editing and dialing, and you know, and I'm feeling a little guilty, like, oh man, you know, I what am I doing?
Yeah.
Okay, when we released, I was like, bro, you got the fucking easy job. You just had to, I got to respond to everybody. I got to like every message. I got to go and follow people, then unfollow people, and then boost this post and unboost it. Like, dude, that's a full-time.
Now you're a social media manager.
You're doing all that still?
Yeah, I'm doing all of it. You're like, you're crazy.
I remember when we
early. You guys got to think. I'm only 4 months into this thing. Right. You know, last I looked at your guys' page, you guys have like 2,000 videos or posts or whatever you call it.
I can't even count.
Dude, yet. I think we have like 200.
Well, we always start lean.
Yeah, I'm a big believer in starting lean. Like, yeah. I'm a sweat equity guy. When I start turning a profit, that's when I start to hire.
Sure.
So I'm just not there yet.
Yeah.
You know, if you guys are able to do that, it's because you're there. You know, I'm just.
We don't have a lot of people, though. It might look like that with the outward-facing result of what you see in the post and the frequency and how they're edited. But we have one remote editor and one person that works alongside us.
Really?
That's it.
Yeah.
It doesn't take a huge team to do it, you know, on the level we're at.
Yeah.
You know, it really
remote
doesn't.
Editor, like, how do they know when there's a good point to cut?
They're just so good at it. They've done it for other people way bigger than us.
Yeah.
So you send them an hour-long podcast.
Just like you send this.
Yep.
And they know what to cut out and they know what to keep. And
they'll give you the 15
And most of what we do is short form. So it's like we're going to sit down and film a video and it might be 45 seconds and they're going to cut it to 35. So it's like they're not cutting a whole lot.
We actually just streamlined it a little bit more. We brought in a really high-level team. They managed the Hermosis and Cardone and have done a lot of work for Pineda. And we were filming every Wednesday for 4 or 5 hours every Wednesday. This team came in. We spent, 12 hours last week filming
all
them?
One full day, and we got enough. We get 3 months' worth of videos.
Did they bring the content, content ideas?
So we spent about 3 hours sitting
there. That's the hardest part.
That's one of the hardest parts.
To me, I mean, we can all talk about what we know.
Yeah.
But someone's got to tell us, hey, you do know this, so talk about it.
Yeah. And it wasn't – the strategy behind it wasn't just like – I have 78 rentals and here's how much it makes. It's just
79.
Sorry, I said that twice. 79.
I just keep.
I know you're a picky guy.
I don't give a shit.
No, you do. You do. 79. But the way that we sat down, I don't think we've ever done it in this way. Where usually we sit there and we just write like 21 short forms a week that we think are going to be good. The way they brought it about, I mean, we took literally one concept as a top concept, which was like, who are you guys? All right, we're 32-year-old millionaire entrepreneurs living in Las Vegas that flip houses, was like the basic of who we are, right?
Okay.
In terms of business. That broke down to personal lives and what's going on in Las Vegas and what event, you know, so many strategic breakdowns into hooks and hobbies and who we are as people. Because if you look at our page now, you don't know who I am and you don't know who Jesse is on a
unless they
level.
Started on day one, they don't have right. a clue who you are.
Right. All you know is that we're the Boakley brothers and we flip houses. You don't right. know that I have a 3-month-old child. You don't know that he just got married. You don't know anything about our personal lives, what I do for my hobbies, what he does for his hobbies. And that's very important in the social media world is to connect on a personal front with your followers as well.
Sure.
And I think that's something that we really learned from this new team was like, usually it's like how much money we make, how to flip a house, what is wholesaling, what is Airbnb?
Just all real estate.
All real estate based.
That's even getting like, I feel like I even get a little anxious around that because I'm like, dude, how much more fucking real estate shit or mindset? Because I'm more about mindset. Yeah. That's kind of the direction that I was wanting to go. Can I talk about?
So
that's a good point that you start getting into like your personal stuff.
So they do kind of a pyramid where 80% top of the pyramid is actually hobbies. Your personal life is 80% of your content. Then 10% goes into your expertise, which is just base entry level of what you do for business. And then the last 10% is truly that mastery.
We're going to have to, is this proprietary contacts?
No, he puts that out there.
You're cool.
Yeah. Just the bulk of what you put out is who you are, what you do and why people.
Well, no, I mean like, could I use these people?
Oh, super hard.
Okay.
Yeah.
There's literally like, we had to wait a year for an opening.
They're probably picky about it.
Yeah. Very picky.
All right, and they actually called us and like, hey, we were working with another group in Vegas, but they bailed on us this last week. You want in or out? Like, you got to tell me right now.
Yeah. Got it.
Flying out there.
Got it.
So we're in.
Let's do they give you like outfit change times or is it just all the same?
They help with a lot of that advice. Yeah. They'll pull the ideas out of you. They'll tell you where to sit, how to stand, where to look.
What a treat.
To say. Yeah. It's really nice.
What's the price tag?
So they're,
it's 12,000 for 3 months, 15,000.
Yeah, so 4,000 a month.
Yeah.
4,000 a month.
But every month, he guarantees 1 million views. At least
one video with 1 million.
One million view video, which means you're going to have a lot of other videos that have 500,000, 50,000, 100,000, but at least one million view.
Does he post it for you too?
So their bottleneck right now, and this is why they're hard to get with, is because they have clients where their bottleneck is social media management.
Yeah.
They have the editors, they have the expertise on the videography side, but actually managing is a bottleneck for them right now. So they're going to send us all the content and they're going to give us directions like, hey, pretty much what they're doing is we're taking 60 shorts that we filmed and they're going to cut it into 3 hooks per short. So 3 different edits with different texts, different colors, different overlays, different initial word, and give us 3 of each. And they're going to say, post these 2 back to back. And then we'll tell you when to post the 3rd one of that video.
Jesus.
So total strategic measurement on
this shit is
how to
so
post.
He's good at it, though.
Yeah. So that's going to be interesting to see how it goes. Hopefully we get a couple million
you guys
views.
Will be fine.
We'll revisit 3 months.
Yeah.
We should
commit to a podcast every 3 months.
Yeah,
we would love to do that.
I think it'd be fun.
Yeah.
The reason we wanted to bring up social media early.
Sorry.
And we postponed it to later is to just tell a quick story of like what's come from it. Because we always get asked, well, how does that help you?
Yeah.
You know, who do you find? And the truth is we find people to work with, talent for the company and everyone we want. We find money to invest with. Occasionally deals come through and there's a new partnership to be had where we started flipping in Scottsdale because we found somebody online or somebody who wanted to bring a deal and partner on it. So all of those are kind of the obvious.
I think now using social media, and I tell this to everyone we taught, all of our students in the programs that we coach on, and is our the talent that we bring in is now focused on social media. We don't go to, you know, old school resume sites like Indeed.com to find talent.
No, it's agreed.
You follow us. You know who we are. You know what we do. You love what we do. That's the type of person that I want to bring into the company. So, you know, GCs that follow us. We just got 5 new GCs that are great that followed us. I put a post out. They reached out. they already know what we do. They know who we are. They know the product we put out. So A plus talent on that side, you know, agents coming to the office, they know what the expectation is. They know who, what our office is about and who we are. So I think in terms of finding talent, it's the best use to build and scale a business from, especially if, you know, hey, I need a social media manager now. Well, they're going to see what you do. That's the best place. You don't want to find someone on Indeed that has, you know, some sort of backstory in social media. It's, I want to find the person that follows me.
Right.
That loves what
everyone
we do.
Everyone hits the ground running.
Yeah.
I missed the boat on that.
Yeah.
I really did. I should have been filming from the day I started this game.
Well, we started, like we talked about, it's never too late, right? This is still a new game. So.
Yeah. No, because I'm learning just how valuable it is.
Yeah.
And what's crazy is, to your point, so I had a whole FOMO thing around it. Like, I didn't like going on Facebook because obviously you got a picture of 10 people. You're like, I wish I was there. And I didn't like the feeling that I was having. So I was like, I fucking hate Facebook, and I still do. Anyway, and then I got on Instagram, and I was like, but basically I'm going to summarize. I had this stigma around social. Oh, it's bad. I don't like it. It doesn't make me feel good. And I only want to do things that make me feel good. My block list was like 700. Like, it, you know. Anyway, when I embraced it and started using the tools that this beautiful platform has actually provided, which is like the DMs, the comments,
yeah,
the follows, like actually socializing on social media instead of just observing and scrolling,
mm-hmm,
changed my entire perspective of social media.
It will for everyone.
Yeah.
Because what no one realizes is that 99% of people are consumers of content.
Right.
1% of people create content.
Yeah. And interact.
Yeah.
Right. As a consumer, yeah, you know, that's what I tell my agents. They scroll, they'll go past 10 people. I'm like, bro, go back and like at least all 10 of those. At least you're top of mind when they go to look at their.
Sure.
What were you going to say, Dan?
Oh, no, I was going to talk about Galindo Group Real Estate. We started. When I first got here, I was trying to turn his social media into a reality show. That's why I was following around and stuff. Had we just started you then.
Oh, dude, I'd have a million followers.
Right.
I put a lot of effort.
Yeah.
And
I just focused. I just didn't care because I was like, I need to focus on making money.
Yeah.
You know, and I just focused on flips and didn't give a shit about social.
Well, and I think this goes right into the point that, you know, we keep kind of stalling on with how powerful social media is, where it is a long-term game. You don't know how much you're going to make from it because it's expensive and it's very time consuming. And we haven't really made, well, now with the coaching programs, we've made some money from it, but we probably had 100,000 to 200,000 into social media before it started even giving us a return.
I believe
a lot of time, 2 years.
Sure.
But just recently, about a month and a half ago, I got a call from a guy who got my information off Instagram and goes, hey, I've been following you guys for a while. I love what you and your brother do. You guys put out a badass product. I actually own 2 lots with Strip and City views free and clear in Ascaya. And I don't know how to develop. I don't know how to develop a house.
Ground up.
And I was like, "Oh yeah, we could help you 100%. Let's do it. Let's partner up. We've never built a house, but we're gonna build a house now.
Fuck yeah!"
So, he's throwing in the land. He's coming up with half the construction. We're gonna come up with half the construction costs, and we're gonna build 2 65,000 to 7,000 square foot custom homes in Ascaya and split the profits 50-50.
Wow.
Nice.
So
we're building
from
spec.
Social,
yeah,
social media.
And so, your calling was factual.
Right.
Yeah.
So, you know, all in cost.
Congratulations.
I think, thank you. I think we'll be about $4 million all in for the build with the land included. And there's multiple sales in there recently at like 6.4 to 6.6.
Well, there's nothing left, right?
Right. So $2.5 million, $1.2 million our take per house off social media.
And it just hits.
Yeah.
Isn't that crazy?
Random guy picked up the phone.
Wow.
What is your role there? Like, is because we do consulting to like do a new build.
Yeah.
Is it like a consultant?
It's essentially consulting.
You're like owner representation.
Yeah. We're going to hire a GC. Right. Like he's the landowner, and we're going to hire an architect, and we're going to hire a GC to manage the whole thing. And we're going to we're going to probably provide a lot of input in with the architect.
Yeah.
Within reason. But more so once the house is actually standing, all of the interior design and finishes and make the style really nice.
Your role will not be outshined or your role is huge.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I could totally see that. Like for that guy to take dirt to a finished home, he'd love to have you guys.
He's been sitting on it. He has no idea how to do it.
Right. He probably wants to go make money somewhere else.
Pretty badass deal. So now
it's incredible. We're you guys should be very proud of
some home builders.
Yeah.
We got something for you.
Thank you.
Hey.
That's amazing.
And who knows? Like we do one, it goes well, do another, goes well.
That's my thought, right?
Fucking blue heron.
The amount that you'll learn, you guys may just start doing that.
Yeah. I mean, you do one, you do two, you can do them all.
Agreed.
You know, it is what it is.
Agreed.
We learn pretty quick. We're dedicated to the craft, just like flips. So you do one luxury flip. Yeah, it has bigger numbers on it, but the second one's going to be less scary. You know, you're going to learn lessons from the first one. So I'm pretty excited about it.
Wow. Yeah.
My uncle, he met him. He's 70-something years old. He's been contracting for 45 years, and all he's done is build custom homes.
Nice.
That's all he's done. Yeah. And he knows everything. And he's retired in Spanish Trail over the lake.
So, yeah, you can make some money doing it. I mean,
oh, yeah.
Obviously, you can make some money when doing it. But I want to say, you can make some money doing it. Like, I've seen a lot of little mom-and-pop guys. I'm like, nah, I've never heard of them. But they're living in, like, a $4 million house in Spanish Hills or Spanish Trail.
And they build 2-3 homes a year. Yep. And they've done it for 10 years. Yes, and yeah,
exactly.
What's that one local guy in town? Landon Miller? Do you know who that is?
No.
I don't know if that's who it is.
I only know one Landon.
It's your boy.
That's my boy.
Our architect we met was actually telling us just a quick story about a guy came to town like early and started a vending machine business.
Yeah.
And vending machines in the casinos, grew that, sold that, built his first house like 7, 8, 9 years later. Now he's built like 30 homes and lives in a $4 million house. And he went from vending machines to custom homes.
I think he was like immigrant too.
Probably, yeah.
Those are the best.
Yeah.
I love those guys.
Super cool.
I really do. And you know who I don't like is the fucking spoiled, rotten white American. That's pissed to be an American.
You don't like me?
No.
That's me. But, you know, think of those guys that fucking run around. They're mad at America. I'm like, you have no fucking clue. You have no fucking clue.
Backwards.
Yeah.
Opportunity.
Your ass backwards. You know, and then this guy who comes in and starts a vending machine business without papers, with no money, you know, that guy fucking kissed the ground that he lives on.
Yeah,
you know?
Right.
Yeah, I mean, there's no accidents that most immigrants are Republican.
Well, they've seen what socialism does when they leave their country.
Yeah, that's why they leave.
Okay, I want to talk about my social space, and then and then we can either keep vibing or we'll wrap it up. But so we're going to release a coaching, a course, and a software combined package.
I saw that all coming soon on
did
the
you
website.
Post it?
On the website, it was coming soon.
Did you post it?
It's just the website.
No, but
no, I haven't posted it yet.
How'd you get there?
Your website. It's on your website. There's a page and it says coming soon. There's like products there.
Yeah.
Coming soon.
Danny's just doing his job.
I did my research before I came over here.
Just let your boy do his thing.
Yeah, Danny's the man.
Yeah.
So, what I was thinking, and I'm going to learn a million things, and you guys are going to tell me not to touch the pot, and I'm going to go touch the pot because it's just how I learn. But like, you sell a course.
Okay.
Then if you sell a course, now you have to go find another buyer.
Right.
So now it's like sell as many courses as you can and then keep marketing so that you can find more buyers. Mm-hmm. To me, what I feel like is if you sell a course without coaching, because it's just like anything, it's like handing me the real estate book. And then, of course, I'm going to have a fucking question. Mm-hmm. Of course, I'm going to need clarification on something. So I feel like coaching has to be a component of it. Okay. Now, once these people buy the course, understand the flipping space, have questions, are enrolled in the coaching component, then eventually they're going to learn how to do it on their own and not need me anymore. So now obviously the course is a one-time pop. The coaching is residual, but eventually they may go, you know what? I don't find value in the coaching anymore and move on.
Sure.
So then we said, well, how do we keep them? How do we retain them? We're like, let's create a badass software. The software is the retention component that even if they understand how to do it, they're never going to stop paying for the software. What I was thinking is my initial plan was like, let's get to 50,000 followers, then release, and then we only have to sell to half of 1% to 200. At $250 a month brings in $47,000 a month.
But then he got 2,000 followers in 4 months, and they're all fucking gung-ho.
Yeah, like, they're like begging me for shit, DMing me and going, you know, and so now we're up to 3,500. But they're, for me, like I go through and I block out like the bots and the fake and all this other shit so that like I have a pure audience. Mm-hmm. I'm like, let's assume that 3,000 are real because 500 maybe I didn't scrub them.
Cracks.
You get it. Yeah. So I'm like, 3,000 people, that's a fuckload of people.
Yeah.
You know, so I was like, let's just release it now. Kind of to your point, it's never too late to start. And I'm like, you know what? If it doesn't work or it goes slow, then we'll tweak it then. But why would we wait till we get to 50,000 when we have 3,000 real people? I always screenshot it, click another client. You could, you know, I'm trying to keep pressure on him to build this stuff, which he's doing a great job at. But I'm like, another client. Because people are like, how much is your coaching class? How much is, or when are you going to release a course? Because they all thought that was what I was doing.
Okay. So you're talking about a course, isn't like a pre-recorded, ready to consume
steps? 50?
Course?
or 200?
It's going to be like 100.
Like a video based recorded course?
150 step course on flipping homes is the course component. But I also, and then there's the coaching, which will be, you could have one-on-one coaching, you can have lots of one-on-one coaching, you can have some one-on-one coaching, and then you can have group coaching.
Okay.
And then that will be where they take the information they learned from the course and be able to apply it and talk shop and actually go in. Because what I really want to do is I actually want to see people be successful from it.
Sure.
I always say, like, you know, if all these courses, every single one worked, not that it's about the course. Oftentimes it's not about the course, and I'm very aware of that. You'd have hundreds of thousands of house flippers.
Of course.
You know, but but that's why I think it's important to have the coaching because in the mindset component, because these people buy the course and nobody teaches them that, you know, hating money is bad. You know, nobody tells them that. So they bought this course, but they're still programmed to believe that the rich guy's bad.
Right.
You know what I'm saying? It's like somebody has to reprogram them. And I'm being very general here. You know, there's way more tuning to the brain that's required to be able to go and take the leap from buying regular homes to luxury homes. Like, you know, that's a special mindset. There's not a lot of human beings on the planet that possess that. You know, but it could be taught, it could be shared, you could rewire people to have more confidence, you know, and then anyway, so I think it's important to have all of them. So that's what my ultimate goal is, and we'll see where that takes us.
Nice. Have you thought about monthly subscription or year-long membership or
the
lifetime
software,
membership?
The first answer to your question was the software will be monthly.
Okay.
The coaching is monthly too.
And the coaching is monthly.
Okay.
Yeah.
We talked about when we were at your house. I love the Pace Morby method where
lifetime.
He built that because you seem to kind of want that that tight knit community.
I don't want 100. I want like 30 people in my game. Okay. They're paying me like a dime a month.
Okay.
And low overhead.
That's great.
30,000 a month.
Yeah.
But just because I don't want to fail.
Yeah.
I don't want to let people down. I don't want to disappoint.
You know,
but what were you going to say? I didn't mean to cut you off. I thought
he just has that lifetime membership where it doesn't feel like every month I'm paying and paying. And maybe like this month I have a personal situation going on that I can't afford to pay it. So am I out or what? He has a lifetime membership, which is why I think he's built his network so quickly because it's affordable. I think it was what, like $7,800 or something like that.
You're in for life.
And you're in for life to the Sub2 community. And it's a community. He travels, he speaks, he meets his people. He is one with the people. And I think that's great because it's different from a lot of the other gurus out there who you can't get in touch with. You know, yeah, they have a conference. It costs $3,000 to go to the conference, but they speak and they leave.
Yeah.
Pace is really about going to a small local tavern and making sure his community's there and he sits there as long as he has to answer all the questions he can. And I think that's why he's grown this to 8,000 plus people in the community now. So I'm sure not everyone paid $8,000, but if you do the math on it,
what is that math?
I'm sure it's a pretty good return. Well, that'd be $64 million.
Oh, okay. Yeah, there's no money there.
Does he have a subscription product inside?
I don't know. There's probably spinoff branch products that he does offer and associated business partners of his, and they can get into other programs. I'm sure you can.
Yeah.
But his basic Sub2 community is just lifetime membership.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
But you brought up a good point.
Hit me.
And we don't have to go too much longer, but
dude, I'll stay here all day with you guys.
Yeah. All right. When you got into, you're starting this now, you want to have a small group because you really want to create success for people. You don't want them to fail.
In a perfect world, yes.
Right. Obviously. Yeah. It puts a lot of pressure on you as an educator to not allow people to fail. And this is something I've definitely felt way early on, is very invested in how these people receive the information, use the information, and benefit from it. Like, I felt obligated to show these
people
how to benefit from it. And the reality is, and you're mindset driven too, so that might be a little bit different because you're interested in changing their minds and how they think towards achieving the success. Ours was, we have a great curriculum. We've laid it out for you. We're very invested in communicating it and making sure it's understood. But when you log off, whatever you do afterwards, that's on you. And so it kind of had to eventually just take a grain of salt after grain of salt and understand if somebody wants to listen to me but doesn't want to do a damn thing about it, that's not my problem.
Sure. So there was a moment where you had to
divest.
Yeah.
And you talk to certain people that are complaining, and when you're new to it, you hear the complaints, and immediately that just hits your ego. Like,
sure.
Damn, what am I doing wrong? Like,
great advice.
Why is this happening?
Yeah.
Then you start to get a little thicker skin and ask that person, how many calls did you attend? Did you do this homework? Did you actually look at this file? Did you download it? How many offers did you make? Are you going to do any of those things? Okay,
It has nothing to do with me.
I don't feel bad at all.
Right.
Yeah.
That's just people, right?
Because I taught the same girl over here the same stuff I taught you, and she put it into action, and she just made six figures.
Nice.
So why shouldn't have you? Because you didn't do anything. So you have to understand that.
I won't forget that. I'm sure I'm going to experience it, and I'll remember this conversation.
I think being a part of the bigger programs that are established, you know, everyone wants to feel the way you feel up front, right? Where, look, I'm going to be an educator. I got to be the best I could possibly be, and I want everyone underneath me to succeed. But just naturally, it's hard to go that way.
Oh, sure.
It's hard to sustain that mentality, you know, even with a small group of people, because you're going to get out of 30 people, people aren't going to show up. People aren't going to do what they want to do. And is that a failure to you? No, you're putting all the time and effort you can into those people. But at the end of the day, people are people.
People are people.
But there's a reason why there's a 1% and a 99%.
Right.
We're the 1%.
That's right. You know? That's right, motherfuckers.
And don't worry about over educating. Like, if you talk in your sleep, that's going to be more informational than anything that they've heard from anyone else.
I often am reminded of that.
Yeah.
How little people know about the space.
So we started off, this has got to be, I understand they're starting off from zero, but I got to take them to the highest level of understanding in this space. And that is just not where everyone wants to go.
Sure.
They don't even have the capacity to do that. So just breathing in a direction is more informational than they've gotten from anywhere else.
Wow.
You have to understand that too. It's like everyone's literally starting from not from scratch, from below scratch.
Yeah.
When it comes to this.
Well, I'm gonna be calling you guys. Landon.
He told me I was stupid.
Right. He doesn't like chapter 2.
Lots of refund.
Well, before we go, I just want to humanize everybody, because a lot of this network of investors, it's like they get, who the fuck are they? It's like, you're just an investor. That's all you do. Like, what do you guys do for fun? Like, what's your weekend? You're off. You just had a great week. Like, what's your go-to?
Sure. So, like, hobbies, interests.
I'm actually curious about
you.
Yeah. About me?
About you. Because I know this guy's a family guy.
Yeah.
Not that you're not, but he's got a kid on the way, so I could probably tell him what he does.
He just had
He's not on the way. He's there.
He's here.
3 months in.
3 months.
That's pretty recent. He's a family guy as of 3 months.
This guy hasn't left the house for 3 months.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. So one of my favorite things to do is to get out of this place. I really love it, and I love all that it's given to me, but to me, the world is very big, and I really love to see it. And so whether it's just getting out of town to a new place or a new city or going to meet somebody that I know that lives somewhere else, like, I really try to schedule stuff all the time. I don't want to go 1 month without going somewhere.
Wow.
And that's just me. That just keeps me, like, living. Just feels good to...
I have that in me.
Yeah.
I just want to, like, I was telling them, like, Chicago, we've never been.
I just want to get on a plane and go somewhere.
Yeah.
I really enjoy that.
Do you care, Landon?
I like traveling. I mean, I travel a lot, too. I don't go to new places all the time, but, you know, I love getting down to California with the family. You know, love going back to New York once or twice a year. I like to travel too. I don't get to do it as much as I'd like to, but
you do like it.
I do.
I didn't know.
I love it.
I don't give a shit.
Are you doing like little 2-day trips, 3-day trips, just on the weekend?
Weekend trips when I can, but like, fortunately, like, my wife's family now is all over the place, so I can go all different places. But the more you travel, the more you realize, wow, I've seen a fraction of what is here on this world, and I have a very limited time to go see it.
Yeah.
And so it's up to you whether you're going to be full of experience or not. And like, just going to the same place like over and over is just death to me.
Mm.
Like, I even our parents, like, Newport Beach.
Right.
Fuck Newport Beach. Enough
it's
of that.
A habit.
Like, it's okay, we've seen it. It's lame. Like, go somewhere else.
Like, I want to go to Bryanhead again.
Yeah. Go somewhere else.
All right, cool.
Yeah.
Cool. All right, Landon.
I've just not been sleeping for 3 months.
Oh, well, yeah, you got a newborn.
Yeah, but he's awesome, though. You know, it's a complete change of mindset, of course. You know, gratitude lately has been a lot higher. You know, that there's a lot of thoughts, you know, at 3 a.m. when you're holding the little baby, and it's just a different way of living now. So, you know, having the pressure to perform for him is a lot higher, which I'm sure you know.
Oh yeah.
So, you know, the stress level of, look, I gotta fucking go. I gotta make it now.
Yeah.
You know, I got this guy. It's a whole different mindset. And you hear people say it that have kids, but you don't get it until you have a kid.
Sure.
Where that mentality comes from. So that's been big lately. You know, health and getting back in better shape and not sleeping, but still waking up every morning and getting into the gym at 6 a.m. You know, it's not easy to do when you're up all night.
Sounds tough.
You got to do it. So
tough.
Yeah, that's what my lifespan is. Just
what time's the baby waking up? Is it consistent?
So he was doing good for about 2 weeks, but these last 2 weeks, it's been
you got to go to sleep
every half hour.
Oh man,
you know, he's been rough the last 2 weeks.
Is the lady running there a lot of it, or is this a tag team? Some people either
tag team.
I don't even remember what I did. It's been so long. I won't even comment on it.
And you're delusional anyway, so
yeah, I know. What I do remember is thinking, okay, how do they torture people in the military?
Yeah,
sleep deprivation.
Yep,
and then they fucking blare loud noise. Okay, what is a kid doing? It's keeping you from sleeping, exactly. And then screams in your face, bro. My first kid was so colicky, Beckham.
Oh, that's crazy.
That I had, because we were on the high five schedule. So Crystal, I'd come home from work and then I'd have to keep him up as late as possible so that he could sleep in, so that when Crystal could get sleep. Anyway, that was our game for the first year. And I would get so much anxiety from his crying that as soon as I got home and Crystal left, I put in the earplugs and then I put on gun shooting headphones.
Oh.
Bro, I could operate flawlessly.
You're just walking around your house that way.
I had three rules with the kid. Is he fed? Does he have a clean diaper? And is he safe? And if I knew that those were the three things and he was still crying, then I just fucking let him cry.
Yeah. Well, I heard an interesting take. They're so new to the world that even an itch in the middle of their back that they can't touch could just set them off, because they have no fucking clue what that is.
Good point.
Yeah. Imagine being like 3 months old and like every 30 minutes you wake up into like a dark room with no one there. No, mom's not there. Dad's not there.
We called it the sleep monster.
Yeah.
That's actually the best description of why they get crazy before they go to sleep.
Yeah.
Imagine if all of a sudden we're all vibrant, right? We're all alive right now and feeling good. Eventually today we're going to get tired. Imagine not knowing what that feeling is and why it's trying to take us. It's like why is it trying to take me?
It's like you're dying.
Right.
Yeah.
No wonder they go nuts before they're tired, before they go to sleep.
But we started crying it out last night. So last night was the first night where you put him in the crib,
let it cry
for 3 minutes, and then you go check on him. Then it's 5 minutes, and then 10 minutes.
Is that the Ferber method?
Yeah, I think it is.
I learned that from Meet the Fockers.
Yeah, so
I just started
it's hard listening to him scream for 10 minutes, but what's interesting is by like minute 8 or 9, they're out.
Yeah. No, I loved the 10-minute deal because it fucking knocked them out. Think how much energy they use screaming.
So much.
Right.
Yeah. No, mine was 8 minutes.
So last night he slept better than he slept the last 2 weeks, and he was crying crying until he just fell asleep, versus, you know, he would cry before and, oh, we got to
pick him up.
We got to run. You know?
Yeah. That's a good point. Crying, that's killer parenting advice.
Yeah.
Let's recap that, because there are some people who are listening, they're parents or about to be parents. If the kid's crying and you pick them up and you soothe them to sleep, they still have all that energy in them.
Yep.
Then they wake back up. If you let them cry it out for 10 minutes and then pass out, that's going to be a much deeper sleep because they've used so much energy crying.
Absolutely.
Fuck yeah.
That's love it.
Tanks are empty by then.
Right. That's all they got.
Yeah.
All right, you guys, you've been amazing. Keep crushing the real estate game. And
you too, man.
What a treat to have the Bulkley brothers on.
Absolutely.
Appreciate you guys.
Pleasure.
Thank you very much.
Hey, guys, that's going to do it for today's episode. If you guys want to learn more about the tools, tips, and tricks that I use on a daily basis to maintain my success, stay connected with me through all of my socials at I Am Josh Galindo.